May it please the court, my name is Chris Forsyth, here on behalf of appellant Patrick Young. My registration number is 22608. We're here about fairness and impartiality. Judicial conduct can lead to a reversal where it is shown that the judge's conduct so departed from the required impartiality as to deny a fair hearing. And that's what's happened below. At the same time, this matter was pending before the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. The Industrial Claim Appeals Office was proceeding in this court, represented by counsel, advocating against Mr. Youngs. Case law shows that a judge cannot be an advocate and a judge at the same time. And that's what occurred in this case. In fact, the Colorado Supreme Court said in such an instance, due process is a sham. And once you understand that, then I think you understand the rulings of the ICAO below. In regards to the summary judgment issue, which I'll address first, the ICAO ruled it did not have jurisdiction to rule on the summary judgment issue because it claimed that a petition to review was not timely filed. But the record clearly shows that within 20 days of when the ALJ issued an order of summary judgment denying benefits based on this summary judgment, a petition to review issued. That petition to review issued on July 15, 2011. 3 days later, another petition to review issued from ALJ Jones's order. So there were two judges, Judge Kane, who issued the summary judgment order, and Judge Jones, who issued the full findings of fact, conclusions of law order. And we proceeded to hearing. So those two petitions to review were filed 3 days apart. The ICAO ruled essentially that the petition to review the summary judgment order was filed 3 days too soon. That's their argument. We contend, number one, that either way, if you consider the ALJ Kane's order final, then a petition to review was timely filed. If you consider it interlocutory, then no petition to review was required. And under either way, the appellant prevails on this argument.
Excuse me, on the second petition for review that was filed on July 18th,
yes.
There's no reference in that petition to review to the summary judgment order, is there?
That's correct.
And the statute providing for petitions for review, I believe, requires that you set forth, or that the petitioning party set forth in detail, the reasons for the appeal, correct?
No. The statute says for the order. So they've set forth the particular review errors in the order.
Yes.
So,
and that didn't happen here, right? Because there was no reference to the particular errors in, or to anything in regarding Judge Kane's order. Correct?
That had already been done on July 15th, 3 days prior.
Was that incorporated by reference in the second petition for review?
I don't believe so. It was already filed. So,
you're saying if we just look at the second one, that that's sufficient. And so I'm trying to figure out how is that sufficient?
Because if you believe what Pinnacle has said and what the ICAO has said, then ALJ Kane's order is interlocutory. And under case law, no petitions to review are required of interlocutory orders. So a petition to review wasn't required of that order, period. And there's no rule that says you have to follow it, and at this point it turns into a final order, and then you have to specifically do something at that point. We're caught in a trick here. That's what the ICAO is arguing, that you have to follow all the orders in the work comp process, and then now you have to attach them all to this final petition to review. And if you don't, you miss all those grounds. So if you had a pre-hearing law judge order, any of those orders, you would have to attach all of them. That's not been the practice in workers' compensation. The practice is to attach the final full findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, as was done in this case of ALJ Jones's order.
How do we know that that's the practice?
because if you read the work comp decisions, that's all that's ever required. And if you go to the American Express case, which was specifically cited in the briefs, this is that case, whereas the interlocutory was order was deemed a part of the final order. Now, they're going to argue that, well, the language in American Express says in conjunction with. It was presented in conjunction with. We contend this was presented in conjunction with because it was filed within 3 days of the same order, and also it's part and parcel of the order. How can it seems disingenuous to, on the one hand, argue it's interlocutory, but then argue it becomes final at this point and you have to attach something about it. The statute says you appeal a final order that denies benefits. In that case, in this case, we contend, first of all, King's order did deny benefits. It denied medical and temporary benefits based on a theory of law. Okay? So we believe it's final, it was appealed timely, end of story. Number two, if you agree with the panel below that it was for some reason interlocutory, failed to be final, then there's no petition to review that's required. None. The statute does not say you have to file all orders. It says file the order, and we did so with ALJ Jones's order. So any way you spell it, whether it's final or it's interlocutory, we believe we've met the requirements of the statute and the appeal was timely filed.
American Express was decided prior to the change in the statute, was it not?
The statute changed in 2009. The American Express case is 1985. Yes, that's correct. The statute changed, and that's a good point. The statute did change. This case was filed in 2005. But arguably this is a procedural change in the statute, whereas the statutory language changed in 2009 from, it used to say within 20 days from the date of the certificate of mailing of the order. So now it says after, it put insert of the word after in the statute. So arguably under the 2005 language, we are clearly in the confines of that language. It's the word after that triggers the issue in this case.
There is a difference. You concede that there's a difference in the meaning of from and after the change that was made in the statute?
It's written differently. I mean, after is clearly, it wasn't clear before that it's within 20 days from the date of the certificate of mailing of the order was the previous language. And, you know, that can be argued either way. Now the statute specifically says after the date of the certificate of mailing of the order. But here, again, we did file a petition to review of ALJ Jones's order within 20 days of its issue. But underlying that was the admitted interlocutory order stated by the ICAO or Pinnacle, which case law is that you don't file petitions to review of interlocutory orders. So I don't know what else to say.
That interlocutory order being ALJ Kane's order granting partial summary judgment for the employer would become final when would that become a final order?
It's part, that's what we believe the American Express case says, is that it is part of the final order. It's part of the case. If you rule the way ICAP is going, we're going to have to start briefing issues and attaching every order to a petition to review, a completely different process than in all other civil actions in Colorado where notice pleading, notice appeals are sufficient. Here, they're arguing for an incredibly highly technical requirement where we have to put all the interlocutory orders attached to the final order to appeal.
Counsel, I think we're looking at a statute. And the statute is something that we have to construe and give effect to. Section 8-43-3012 doesn't talk about attaching the orders, although I think that's probably part of the rules. But it says, requires that a petition for review set forth in detail the particular errors and objections of the petitioner. And I think that's different than notice pleading, and I didn't write the statute, so I don't know what they're doing.
I'm sorry.
But, I mean, go ahead, you're going to explain that.
If you go down to paragraph 12, then it says, these are the only errors of review. And then the statute says only if there's insufficient evidence for appellate review, if the law does not support the conclusions of law, if the fact does not support the conclusions of fact, the only things you can allege, so the statute says that, give us particular errors, but then the statute says in paragraph 12, these are the only things you can allege. So the general, so as you'll see on all the petitions review get filed in the court, that language is used, the language from paragraph 12, and that's put on everyone. That's the notice.
So you're saying that the notice that was filed on the 18th contains all that language and that that's sufficient?
Yes.
Okay.
Briefly, I'd like to address the hearing rulings, and the most disturbing aspect in this case is the evidence of popping in Mr. Young's shoulder. A credibility determination was made at hearing that Mr. Young's was not credible and respondent's expert was. Within that determination was the fact that their testimony was diametrically opposed on whether there was popping or crepitation in Mr. Young's shoulder. It was offered into evidence that the witness and the judge feel the shoulder at the hearing to determine the credibility of who's telling the truth. Is there popping in Mr. Young's shoulder? The judge wouldn't do it. This was the
same. How is the judge qualified to make that determination? I mean, does he or she have any medical training?
No, but they can just feel popping in the shoulder. They can make an answer. It's just like touching someone, whether they're, well, sometimes we have complex regional pain syndrome cases, and you can have a judge touch them to feel the difference in the temperature in their extremities, because the difference in temperature is one of the symptoms of complex regional pain syndrome. It's just evidence in a case. If you were before a jury, you could have a jury, you know, touch the shoulder or look at the evidence. It's just evidence in the case. And the evidence was clear, if the judge would have touched the shoulder, that there was popping. And that one piece of evidence could have completely changed the outcome in this hearing. Because if the expert witness had denied the popping or crepitation, Youngs had said it was there, and then the judge felt the shoulder and felt the popping, then the judge would have to rule in Mr. Young's favor, because he is the witness that's more credible. And this was the same judge who denied cross-examination of that expert on various articles regarding overuse syndrome. And then the last issue was a doctor's report. Did the expert request a doctor's report before he wrote his report? And I'd like to reserve my little time remaining for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, registration number 22605, and I represent the respondents Light Moving and Storage and Pinnacle Assurance. I'd like to start off with discussing the arguments regarding ALJ Kane's partial summary judgment order. First of all, under 843.301, there's no requirement and there's no rule that requires a party to attach orders to a petition to review. And 843.301 subparagraph 8 deals with the grounds on which the Industrial Claim Appeals Office can disturb an ALJ's order. So it's subparagraph 8, not subparagraph 12. And with regard to the argument that it's practice only to petition review the final order that's entered in a claim, at the Industrial Claim Appeals Office level and below, we cited an ICAO case, McCormick, which is cited in my brief, where this exact situation occurred, and the ICAO held that an order that was not a final appealable order was interlocutory until the final appealable order was entered, and that the party was required, the appealing party was required to appeal the earlier order in conjunction with the subsequent final order in order to preserve the appeal of the first order.
Mr. Forsyth seems to contend that placing these criteria in subsection 8 in the petition to review the final order is sufficient to bring into that petition to review the issues sought to be reviewed from the interlocutory order. How do you respond to that?
Well, subsection 8 only governs the actions of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. What they can do, what grounds they have to set aside or reverse an ALJ's decision. It's subparagraph 2, I believe, or earlier in the statute that talks about the parties specifying the grounds for appeal. So subsection 8 does not specify or does not govern what a party must do in a petition to review. It only governs what the ICAO can do with regard to the order of an ALJ.
What basis the panel may be able to reverse the ALJ's ruling?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's similar to 843-308 with regard to the Court of Appeals. That sets forth the grounds to what the court can do when an ICAO order is appealed to the Court of Appeals.
You're talking about subsection 2 where it says that the petition to review shall be in writing and shall set forth in detail the particular errors and objections of the petitioner.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you're saying that that particular sentence in subsection 2 requires that those details be incorporated in the petition to review the final appealable order.
Yes, Your Honor. And if a Westlaw search will reveal probably hundreds of ICO cases where the ICO mentions the fact that the petitioner only listed the general grounds for reversal in their petition review, and basically saying that doesn't help them a whole lot in reviewing the order, especially if they didn't file a brief. So the practice is to set forth the specific grounds for error in your petition review, and that's what the statute requires.
Why wouldn't the fact that Mr. Youngs had filed a previous petition to review just 3 days earlier concerning the ALJ's order regarding a partial summary judgment, why wouldn't that
alert,
that's the word I'm looking for, why would that not alert the panel to his desire to review both of these at the same time?
Well, number one, the petition review is first filed with the Office of Administrative Courts, so the petition actually goes straight to the ALJ who issues the order originally, and that ALJ controls that appeal until the briefs are filed. As a matter of fact, has 30 days to issue a supplemental order or forward the case to the ICAO. So here we have two judges involved, so the ICAO is not involved until the ALJ who issues the final order, and when the petition review is filed, sends the case to the ICAO. So that's why it's a technical argument to some degree, because the appeal is actually filed with the ALJ. And when ALJ came and received the petition review, he didn't have an appealable order that could be passed on to the ICAO. It was only after, so his order was interlocutory until ALJ Jones issued a final appealable order. So the only appropriate petition review had to go to ALJ Jones. She did not get that first petition review, and that's why technically that first petition review was improper, because you didn't have an appealable order.
The petition to review the ALJ Kane's order would have never been forwarded to the panel, to ICAO. Am I understanding that correctly?
I don't know. What happened in this case was Pinnacle moved to dismiss that first petition review because We recognized that it was an interlocutory order at that point. Now, ALJ Kane denied our motion, and it wasn't until it went up to the ICO that the ICO held that it didn't have jurisdiction because that first petition review was improper, and there was no appeal of ALJ Kane's orders until, or there was no, when his orders became final, there was no petition review filed of his orders. There was no mention of ALJ Kane's orders in the petition review.
But it got there.
It did get there.
Okay.
But technically, it probably shouldn't have.
Thank you. Okay.
One thing I want to mention in claimant's reply brief, he mentions the failure to, or the fact that the statute 843.301, I believe, does not permit reply briefs, and he argues that that's a denial of due process. He cites several ICAO cases where they declined to consider reply briefs. I can cite a couple of cases or more where the ICAO has granted motions for parties to file a reply brief and an appeal to them. And I have it right here. Okay. The Franz case is 2009 Westlaw 1557343, was decided in 2009, where the claimant filed an unopposed motion for permission to file a reply brief, and the ICO granted it under 843.301 subparagraph 9. And there's another case, Procopio versus Army Navy Surplus, 2005 Westlaw 1405001, where a motion to strike a reply brief that was filed by the claimant was denied by the ICAO. So so there's in practice and under the law, a party can request leave to file a reply brief. It's not, and the ICAO uses its discretion to determine whether they will accept that. In this case, the claimant did not attempt to file a reply brief. So the argument that somehow they were denied due process by the inability to file a reply brief has no merit.
Those cases, either way, are not binding on us.
They're not binding on you, but
so the, and I'm not aware. Are you aware of any appellate case, any court of appeals case or Supreme Court case that has answered that question?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I'm just pointing out that the argument that the ICO cases have prohibited him from filing a reply brief, that's not a valid argument based on the fact that the ICAO has permitted reply briefs at the lower level in the past.
So someone would have to ask for permission to file a reply brief, be denied permission, and then take that on appeal to get a answer to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Most of everything else, I believe, has been covered in my briefs, except on the argument in his reply brief, the claimant argues that if the court finds that the ICO's decision that it did not have jurisdiction to consider ALJ Kane's orders was wrong, that the court should just remand it. Well, under 843.312, I think the Court of Appeals could remand it, or they could issue an order affirming if the court somehow decides that it was improper for the ICO to say it didn't have jurisdiction. Now, in Pinnacle's answer brief, we set forth an argument as to why ALJ Kane's granting of the partial motion for summary judgment was correct. I did want to point out that one of the issues that were raised by Pinnacle in its motion for partial summary judgment was that this fraud argument was barred by issue or claim preclusion. And I'll note that it was in the Youngs 2 case, which was 2012 Court of Appeals 85. The court ruled that claimant's first petition to reopen on fraud, which is the exact same petition to reopen we have before us now, for failure to disclose relationships. That was That argument was previously was articulated in the original Youngs case, which went up to this court, the court of the Colorado Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. And this court judge held that this basic fraud was previously articulated in the Youngs 1 case and was not a novel argument. And because of that, the court determined that it was not ripe for adjudication, while the original appeal, the Youngs 1 case, was pending. And that statement is, again, at 2012 Court of Appeals 85, paragraph 19, where that ruling was made. So essentially, that's the law of this case, I believe, that the fraud issue is not a novel argument. It was previously articulated. And that was another reason for that ALJ Keene could have used to dismiss the petition to reopen on the basis of fraud. But he didn't get there. Judge Keene issued his order based on a failure of proof on the claimant's part to show that there was any damage or injury as a result of this alleged failure to disclose Pinnacle's relationship or financial relationship with MedOps management. As far as counsel's initial argument on oral argument, he talks about, and in his reply brief, talks about the ICAO advocating at the Court of Appeals while this was pending before ICAO. The first time the claimant raised this argument, I believe, was in his reply brief. It was not raised at the ICAO, so our position is that issue was waived. I will point out that under 843.307, when the claimant filed his petition to review, he named the ICAO as a defendant in this action, as the statute contemplates. And under 843.401, it talks about the ICAO may request representation by the Attorney General's office to defend appeals such as this. So the intent of the General Assembly, at least, is that the ICAO be represented by the Attorney General's office in appeals such as this, and that's not evidence of a lack of impartiality or denial of fairness.
Let me ask you another question before your time runs out here. I think I have this right that Mr. Forsyth is arguing that ALJ Keene's order, at least under one theory, would have become a final order because ALJ Keene denied your motion to dismiss the petition to review, and you didn't appeal that order or didn't seek review of that particular order. How do you respond to that?
Under 843.301, we can only appeal an order that requires the payment of benefits or penalties. ALJ Keene's order did not require Pinnacle to pay any benefits or penalties. Therefore, if we would have tried to appeal it, it would have been an interlocutory appeal. We cannot appeal that order. So we were left with arguing to the ICAO that that motion was improperly denied, and that and of course it was subject matter jurisdiction that could be raised at any time, at least once we got up to the ICAO. But it was not an appealable order because it did not award any benefits or penalties.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Forsyth, it looks like you have about a minute and 49 seconds left.
By their not appealing that order that was just discussed, we didn't receive due process because we didn't get to respond to these arguments at the ICAO. These issues that we've talked about in this oral argument were not brief. There was no notice and opportunity to be heard at the ICAO because we did not know that Pinnacle was alleging that ALJ Keene was incorrect in his stating that the petition to review was timely filed.
Pinnacle responded in their answer brief that you had argued that in your response to their motion for partial summary judgment before ALJ Keene, and then that was included in the record before the panel.
It was argued before ALJ came, but it was not argued before the ICAO until Pinnacle raised it in their answer brief. And as is shown, we're not supposed to file the language in these ICAO cases says there's no provision of law that allows for the filing of a reply brief, has been the ICAO's rulings. So based on that, we did not file a reply brief.
In this court, though, you have fully briefed that issue, right?
Fully briefed yes, because it's been on appeal from the ICAO, but it was not heard back then. This case has layers of unfairness. My client is out his financial livelihood for the remainder of his life. Is it work comp? It is, but it's very, very serious. It could not be more serious. It's more serious than district court cases that come up before you every day. And he's been denied the due process, simple due process, fairness required by the Constitution. I'd ask that you reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And the court thanks both counsel for your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.